Our argument for the morning is 823-1532, Dabney versus Van Reed. As all parties are aware, the appellant will have 15 minutes for their argument in chief. The respondent will have 15 minutes, and finally, appellant will have 5 minutes for rebuttal. So whenever you're ready, counsel, just approach the microphone, adjust it to your level with the podium, and just tell us who you are in a loud, clear voice, please. Pretty cool, huh?
It's very cool. We like courtrooms with technology. This is very nice.
Well, it costs $200,000, so it should work.
Yep. Good morning. May it please the court and counsel. I'm Matt Barber with my colleague, Cordy Lawrence, on behalf of the appellant, Ednica Dabney. As the court's aware, we're here with two issues. We've got our renewed motion for judgment as a matter of law, and we've got our motion for new trial based on the jury instructions. And I'd like to start with the motion for judgment as a matter of law. With respect to renewed motions for judgments as a matter of law, this court looks at it de novo, although it does look at the evidence in a light most favorable to the verdict, but it does that review independently. And usually we would have to show something like overwhelming evidence. But the argument we're making here is, given the testimony from the defendant here, the respondent, about his following too close, we've triggered a statutory violation, which gives us a prima facie showing that needs to be rebutted by evidence of excuse or justification. And the record does not show any evidence of excuse or justification for why the respondent was following too closely. The record shows that he'd been driving in these conditions for about a half hour. He was on his way home from work that day. He was 2 to 3 car lengths behind Ms. Dabney, and he testified there was not enough room between him and Ms. Dabney given the conditions. He saw Ms. Dabney's brake lights come on, and he hit his brakes as fast as he could and as hard as he could.
Isn't another part of his testimony that he wasn't aware of the conditions, though? That would you agree that that's should be included in your summary?
Yes. Yep. I was just getting to that, Your Honor. Okay. Sorry about that. Yes. So he was aware generally, like this was December 28th in Minnesota. It was slushy. It was a little slippery that day, and then he came across this patch of more slippery ice, essentially. And his testimony is, you know, a few hundred feet back, I thought I was doing everything right. I believed I was doing everything right. But this is a negligence case. His thoughts and his beliefs are subjective things. What we're looking at is objective conduct. And when pressed on cross-examination twice on page 8 and 23 of his testimony, he admits, I was following too close. He has testimony about, you know, I thought I was doing everything right when I was in that situation. But unfortunately, he put himself in that situation by following too closely before or when he came across that rough patch of ice there, Your Honor. And that's our position, is that we've got the evidence of the statutory violation, and there's no evidence to excuse or justify the following too close. We've got evidence of Mr. Van Vrede, the respondent, trying to...
But isn't his testimony really from hindsight? I mean, his testimony is... He's not, this isn't a case where he said, I knew I was following too close. This is a case where he's saying, at least as my understanding of his testimony, is now that the accident has happened in hindsight, I was following too close because I didn't know I was going to hit a patch of ice. And is there a distinction for the purposes of our analysis between those two potential ways this testimony could have come in and the way that it did come in this case?
I want to make sure I'm tracking Your Honor's question. I want to give you a good answer. So it's based on hindsight. Is that a material difference?
Yeah. Is the fact that he's saying, because the way I read his testimony is he's saying, well, the accident happened. So in hindsight, sure, I was too close. As opposed to, I knew I was too close at the time that this was happening. I was tailgating her. Is there a material difference between that for the purpose of our analysis?
I don't believe so, Your Honor, because every time there's going to be testimony, it's always going to be given after the fact. And he's always going to testify, you know, when I was following, I might not have thought I was following too close, but then, you know, this accident happened and I found myself in this situation where I realized, oh no, I'm following too close. That's why I need to hit my brakes as fast as I can and as hard as I can to try and avoid this collision. That's what the testimony shows. And as far as after the fact goes, that would go for any statute violation or any type of negligence. It would be after the fact. So speeding, for example, say the the argument was he was speeding and he was going too fast for the conditions. He might think, I'm going fine for conditions, and then come across something and hit it, and then after the fact realize, oh no, I've been going too fast for these conditions, and now I need to do something about it. It's this conduct before encountering the condition that's important there.
But, I mean, I guess my question is, isn't the fact that that is the inquiry what brings us into more of the Plowman analysis as opposed to the Wilson analysis? The fact that it's not a black and white question, it's more of a what would a reasonable person do? Why doesn't that bring this case into more of the Plowman line of cases?
Because his testimony is, you know, when I was in the situation, I thought I was doing everything I could. But then when he realizes this is not good, I'm in a dangerous situation, he realizes I've been following too close this whole time. And we've got that admission twice, and I don't believe Plowman had the admission or had that type of admission. I could be mistaking that with a different case, Your Honor.
Well, I think Plowman is saying that when we're looking at the, you know, prima facie negligence, when you're looking at a statute that has to do with more of a reasonable, prudent person type standard as opposed to a black and white standard, did you stop at the stop sign or not? That our analysis for the purpose of whether it's prima facie negligence is different depending upon the language of the statute. And the fact that this statute, I think from your own argument, would indicate that there is some kind of reasonable, prudent person type standard. Why isn't that a question that we leave for the jury as opposed to it being sort of prima facie negligence?
Right. And whether or not he was following too closely, it does use reasonable distance. And his testimony was, I wasn't doing that. I was following too close. So he brings us into the statute by saying, I was following too closely for the conditions. That's what the language says of the statute. So we have that yes, no dichotomy here from his testimony. His testimony is, I was following too close. So we fall within the statute there.
I think his testimony was, I was following too closely. I realized after I was unable to stop because I unexpectedly hit a patch of ice. And so I guess I share the concern noted by Judge Larson that I'm not sure that his testimony directly fits into the statute in the way that maybe you're hoping that it does.
And I want to make sure I understand that question. So is it the hindsight issue part of it, basically saying, like, you know?
Well, he testified that he thought he was keeping a reasonable distance from the car, and then, you know, didn't know there was ice on the road, then tried to stop and unexpectedly hit some ice, which made it, you know, challenging for him to stop in time, and he didn't stop in time. And then he realized that, you know, maybe he had been too close given that unknown condition.
And his testimony on page 23, when confronted on cross-exam with his deposition testimony, is, I was falling too closely because it was a little slippery outside. And then he says, I think that's what I've been saying this whole time. So he was falling too closely given the conditions, and it really struck him when he was in that situation, when he saw Ms. Dabney's taillights go on. He realized, oh, I've been falling too close because it's slippery, and now I'm really in trouble here because I need to stop right away, and I can't. And then as far as evidence of justification or excuse for this, there isn't any evidence of that at all. We've got evidence of him trying to avoid the collision, but that's after he was in this situation, his applying the brake and hitting it as fast as he could, that sort of thing. If the court has any other questions about judgment as a matter of law, I'm happy to answer them. Otherwise, I can move on to the new trial based on the jury instructions question. Or if the court doesn't have any questions about the jury instructions, I can
go right ahead.
All right. So with the jury instructions, the standard of review is a little worse for us. It's abuse of discretion for the jury instructions.
Appreciate your candor.
Yes.
It's a lot worse.
Well, yes, that's true. We've got two standards of review between de novo and, abuse of discretion.
Why isn't it plain error?
So
when there was no objection?
When it comes down to, I think it's called, what is it? When it's their substantial rights and it's brought up in the motion for the new trial, then it's been preserved that kind of way. So it's If it were a clear error, that would be a little better for us, but I still think it's going to be, it might be abuse of discretion based on, like, you know, the new trial's abuse of discretion, jury instructions is abuse of discretion. But we
doesn't the plain error standard of review take into account whether there was prejudice to the substantial right of the individual alleging the error?
Thank you for that, Your Honor. Sorry, yes, that's where I should have gone with that. Yes, so we're looking at the plain error of the prejudice to Ms. Dabney's substantial rights, which are the substantive claim for negligence that she's got here that she's okay. asserting.
Just to be clear, so you agree that the plain error standard of review, as opposed to the abuse of discretion standard of review, applies in the context of this case, given the lack of an objection to the jury instructions at trial?
Yes.
Okay.
Sorry about
Thank
that, Your
you.
Honor. Sorry, I was unclear and stumbling, so I appreciate that. Thank you. So when we get to the jury instructions, cases like the Domegalla decisions from this court and the Court of Appeals take a look at, were the jury instructions likely to be confusing to the jury, and did they have a likelihood of prejudicing the plaintiff's substantial rights? And even if we can't tell whether or not there was actual prejudice or not, because it's baseball season, Domegalla says the tie goes to the runner. The plaintiff gets the benefit of the doubt and a new trial. And this jury instruction is confusing to lay jurors. They're not lawyers. They're not judges. They haven't spent 7 years after high school getting a doctorate and reading statutes and cases. They've got the list of instructions given to them by the jury or by the judge and the plain language of those instructions. And this instruction, the fact of accident alone, just says the fact that an accident happened does not mean someone was negligent. And that doesn't sound anything like burden of proof. And it is a burden of proof instruction. Cases like Cuther and Whelan versus Gould say you don't give this instruction when you're arguing unavoidable accident. This has to do with burden of proof. It basically means that the plaintiff still has to show there's some evidence of the other side's negligent conduct or omissions. And someone who's not a lawyer, who hasn't read the authorities in the jury instructions, who hasn't read the cases, isn't going to pick that up from this instruction because it doesn't look anything like the burden of proof instruction. The burden of proof instruction talks about evidence, looking at the evidence, weighing the evidence, giving it credibility or not. This instruction just says just because an accident happened doesn't mean you need to find someone negligent. So
but doesn't Cuther actually endorse using this after the fact, fact of the accident alone instruction in a case like this?
It does so, but it not necessarily in a case like this.
And so in the context of plain error, did the district court plainly err in terms of giving this instruction when Cuther is endorsing using this instruction for a case like this? How do we say the district court is plainly erring when it would appear that there would be at least some law to support what the district court did in this case?
And I'll disagree that it should go to a case like this one because Cuther says it's an instruction not about unavoidable accident. And the whole theory at trial was unavoidable accident. From opening statement through the defendant's testimony through closing argument, it was unavoidable accident, unavoidable accident, unavoidable accident. And Cuther says this instruction is not about unavoidable accident. So it was confusing to the jury because it sounds like this is a substantive defense that is unavoidable accident, and that's the confusion there for the jury. It doesn't sound like it's pointing back to the burden of proof instruction or weighing the evidence at all. It's just saying this is an out, this is a substantive defense is what it sounds like when you don't have all the legal training that lawyers and judges would have and looking at the different cases that form the basis for this instruction. Happy to answer any of the court's questions. Otherwise, I'll come back at rebuttal. All right, thank you.
Thank you. Thank you so much, Mr. Barber. We'll now hear from counsel for the respondent, please.
Good morning, and may it please the court. My name is Michelle Kuhl, and I represent the respondent, Douglas Van Vreed. This case before us today is really no different than the many, many rear-end winter car accidents that happen in Minnesota. Sometimes the jury finds that the rear driver was negligent, and sometimes the jury finds that the rear driver was not negligent. But almost uniformly, the appellate courts have held that that's a decision for the jury to make. And here the jury found that Mr. Van Vreed was not negligent. I think Ms. Dabney's entire argument regarding negligence as a matter of law is based on assumptions about Mr. Van Vreed's testimony that are not supported by the record in the light most favorable to the verdict, as this court must view it. Testimony has to be viewed as a whole, and if you look at the whole of his testimony, which we've included in full in our addendum, he says things continuously like, I never said I was at fault. I did everything I could. I was not aware of the ice, and I was reasonable and prudent. He also explains why. He says, I was traveling 2 to 3 car lengths behind at 25 miles an hour, despite not having encountered icy patches up to that point, and driving a similar distance to other cars on the road. So with all of this evidence, again, viewed in the light most favorable to the verdict, the jury was well within its discretion to conclude that he was reasonable and prudent. The part of his testimony that Dabney relies upon, saying, you agree there was not enough room between you and Ms. Dabney to stop given the conditions. Given the conditions, yeah, but it was because there was ice suddenly on the roadway and I didn't notice that before. This is simply admitting the obvious fact that he did in fact collide with her vehicle. It doesn't mean that he was not being reasonable and prudent, because of course, reasonable and prudent is the standard that we follow, and you can have accidents occur without negligence. That is all that he is saying in those quotations that the appellant relies upon. In addition, it should be noted that Dabney argued to the jury that he admitted to violating the statute, and she argued to the trial court, who witnessed the testimony, that he admitted to violating the statute. The jury and the trial judge both concluded that, as a whole, his testimony did not support that conclusion, or at least the jury was within its discretion to find that he did not admit that he was not reasonable and prudent. So this court should not second-guess that at this point. Even if the court did find that he was somehow admitted to violating the statute, that's at most prima facie evidence of negligence. So the jury could still find that he had a justification or excuse, which would most likely be the road conditions. I think the case law is a bit inconsistent about whether it considers road conditions to be not a violation as the first step or a justification or excuse as the second step. But either way, the result is the same, that the jury's conclusion that he was not liable is fully supported. I want to turn next to the jury instruction issue. The jury instruction that's been objected to here states, the fact that a collision has happened does not, by itself, mean that someone was negligent. And it is Dabney's burden to show that that's plain error or fundamental error of law, because she did not object. And she can't meet that burden because the Supreme Court has repeatedly affirmed this exact instruction, and in fact has actually suggested it's error to not give the instruction when there's evidence that suggests the accident may have occurred without negligence. I disagree with the argument that it's confusing at all. The instruction itself can suggests that it's a burden of proof instruction, because it says the fact that a collision has happened does not by itself mean that someone was negligent. That suggests to the jury how they should use that instruction. The comparison to Damagala is not helpful here. Damagala was a very unique case. It describes itself as a unique case.
Tell me about
it. Be happy to. There was the issue of the no duty to warn instruction. And it was confusing because that particular area of law is confusing. But here we don't have that same type of situation. In addition, I would just point out the argument that the instruction was improper because our theme was unavoidable accident. Dabney never objected to our use of the term unavoidable accident at trial, despite, many opportunities to do so. And also, there was a suggestion in the brief that Van Vreed had somehow admitted that this was not an unavoidable accident case. What they actually happened is Dabney requested that the emergency rule instruction be removed from the jury instructions. And all that happened on page 27 of the transcript, it says, defense went ahead and agreed to it and removed that instruction. So agreeing to remove an instruction does not stipulate that the unavoidable accident theme could not be used at trial. As to the order of instructions, Dabney has not cited any case that has held the order of instructions as reversible error when the instructions themselves are legally correct and the jury has been instructed that the order does not matter. And we presume that juries follow their instructions. They were told the order does not matter, and judges are given wide discretion in determining jury instructions. So I think if this court was to nitpick the order of instructions, it would be inappropriate here. Unless the court has further questions.
I don't believe we do.
Thank you. I'd ask that the court affirm the district court on both issues.
Thank you very much. Mr. Barber, you'll have the last word, sir.
Thank you, Your Honor. I'll jump right in. With Van Vreede's conclusory testimony, it's based on his subjective thinking and believing, and that's immaterial for a negligence action because we don't have a mens rea requirement. It's just, were you violating the statute or weren't you? And here his testimony was that he was after looking at it and realizing that he'd been following too close for too long. As far as conflicting, as far as like wishy-washy testimony on the violation goes, the right-of-way cases that we submitted, like Lake versus Riley, show that even if there's testimony from the driver saying, I didn't see the other driver, that's why I didn't yield the right-of-way to him, the Minnesota Supreme Court said that sort of testimony isn't sufficient to get around the prima facie showing. That's why we have the right-of-way cases in our brief. With respect to the jury instructions.
I understand that the case is non-precedential, but we have this Plowman case that says that when the statute incorporates this sort of reasonable, prudent person standard, that the statute itself doesn't lend itself to a prima facie negligence case. And how are we supposed to, because I don't think that you disagree that the language of the statute that you're relying on is the driver of a motor vehicle shall not follow another vehicle more closely than is reasonable and prudent. And that would seem to pretty clearly put this statute into the Plowman vein. And so what's your best case that despite the fact that the statute explicitly says reasonable and prudent, that this is the type of statute where we apply prima facie negligence.
Right, and that's the Minnesota Supreme Court Wilson versus Surge.
But Wilson applied subdivision B, which was you shall not follow within 500 feet of another vehicle, which is like a black and white rule. Were you 500 feet behind the vehicle or were you not 500 feet behind the vehicle, which is different than a reasonable, prudent person standard?
That's true, it was a different subdivision, but it's still the same general statute of following too closely. And there hasn't been a precedential decision saying that just because the statute uses reasonable and there's been an admission that I was following too close, that you don't get the prima facie benefit of that admitted violation.
But I guess you don't disagree that subdivision 8B does not include the reasonable and prudent language. And that's the statute that Wilson, you don't disagree that that's the statute Wilson was interpreting. They weren't interpreting subdivision A.
Correct. It was a different subdivision. I agree with that. And then onto the jury instructions, unless the court has additional questions on judgment as a matter of law. In Cuther, it was not argued that that accident was an unavoidable accident. So that's a material difference in why Cuther probably agreed that that was an okay instruction to give. It also, we also get into the Domagala cases that did have a custom jury instruction, but it's the same analysis. It's the same rules that apply. And this may be a standard instruction, but in Roe versus Money, which I did not cite, I just remembered it, that's a standard instruction case about damages, and both this court and the Minnesota Supreme Court found that it misstated the law and remanded for a new trial with the corrected jury instruction. So that's what we'd ask for here. And then as far as the order goes, again, the perspective that's to be applied to reading the instructions is from a layperson, someone who's not a lawyer, who's not a judge. And regardless of the order that these instructions are given, a layperson is going to see the burden of proof instruction and the fact of accident alone instruction and see that they're very different. One of them, again, talks about evidence and what you get to do with the evidence. One of them just says the fact that an accident happened alone does not mean someone was negligent. They're not going to draw the inference from the one word alone like a lawyer might, especially without additional language in that instruction that points back to the burden of proof or points back to looking at the evidence. It sounds like it's a substantive defense to someone who doesn't have legal training, and that's our contention of what happened here or is a likely prejudice that occurred here, and that's why under cases like Domagala, it should be remanded for a new trial. Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you very much, counsel. The matter is submitted, and we'll be issuing our decision in 90 days. That being our last oral argument of the day, we are adjourned.